In 1973, Alicia's circumstances started to improve. She had filed a sex discrimination suit against Boeing, one of the companies that had turned her down for a job in the late 1960s. It was a feisty thing to do, and the suit, which eventually netted her a modest out-of-court settlement, helped boost her morale. She got a programming job at Con Edison in New York City, where her old college friend Joyce Davis was working. It wasn't easy. She got up every morning at 4:30 to make the 2-hour commute from Princeton Junction to Con Edison's Gramercy Park headquarters in downtown Manhattan, and came home well past 8 every evening. She often felt frustrated by the work itself, her boss Anna Bailey, another acquaintance from MIT, recalled. She felt that her brains and education weren't being sufficiently recognized. But now that she was making a good salary again, she was able to enroll Johnny in the Petty School, a private preparatory school in Hightstown, about 10 miles west of Princeton. Johnny, who had become moody and difficult at home, was nonetheless an excellent student. By the end of his sophomore year, when he won a Rensselaer Medal in a national competition, he had a 4.0 average, and he was showing a marked interest in and a talent for mathematics. John talked to Johnny a lot about mathematics when he was growing up, Alicia later recalled, adding, "If his father hadn't been a mathematician, Johnny would have been a doctor or a lawyer." Johnny started hanging around the Fine Hall common room to play chess and go and talk mathematics with various graduate students. Amir Asadi remembered him as gentle, a nice kid, a tiny bit awkward, like other mathematicians until they find their context. Johnny was obviously gifted. Asadi recalled that he was studying very high-powered math books. Sometimes father and son would come to Fine Hall together. Johnny didn't seem embarrassed, but neither did he ever refer to his father when talking to the students. Asadi recalled, "He disappeared one day. When he came back, he'd shaved his head and had become a born-again Christian." In 1976, Solomon Leder was visiting his friend Harry Gonshore, the same Gonshore who had been part of Nash's crowd at MIT, now a professor on the Princeton faculty, at the Carrier Clinic. As the orderly ushered Leder through the locked door of the ward, a tall, wild-eyed young man suddenly loomed before him. "Do you know who I am?" he shouted right into Leder's face. "Do you want to be saved?" Leder noticed he was clutching a Bible. Afterward, Gonshore told him that the man was the son of John Nash. By the time Johnny was hospitalized at Carrier at his mother's initiative, he had been truant for nearly a year. He had dropped all of his old friends. For many months, he had refused to leave his room. When his mother or grandmother tried to intervene, he lashed out at them. He had begun reading the Bible obsessively and talking about redemption and damnation. Soon he began hanging out with members of a small fundamentalist sect, the Way Ministry, and handing out leaflets and buttonholing strangers on street corners in Princeton. It was not immediately obvious to Alicia or her mother that Johnny's troubling behavior was anything more than an outburst of adolescent rebellion. In time, it became clear that Johnny was hearing voices, and that he believed that he was a great religious figure. When Alicia tried to get him into treatment, he ran away. He stayed away for weeks, and Alicia had to go to the police for help in tracking him down and bringing him back. And then when her son was in Carrier, Alicia learned that the thing she most dreaded, had dreaded all along, was true. Her brilliant son was suffering from the same illness as his father. Johnny seemed to improve quickly after the first hospitalization, but he did not return to school for 3 years. Alicia never talked about him at work, except when she was forced to ask for time off. She never told anyone at Con Edison that John Nash was living with her again. Like Virginia Nash a decade earlier, she treated her woes as her private sorrow. She tried to cope with Johnny's refusal to take medication, his constant running away, his periodic need for hospitalization, and the terrible drain on her slender resources, without giving in to her own depression. "You sacrifice so much, you put so much into it, and then it all goes," she said later. As the trouble with Johnny overwhelmed her, Alicia turned to her friend Gabby Burrell for support. Gabby accompanied Alicia on visits to Carrier, and later to Trenton Psychiatric, talked with her on the telephone, and invited the Nashes to dinner. Moore confirms this. "Gabby is the closest female friend Alicia has around here. Gabby is very good. Nobody else was around consistently." Gabby's tribute to Alicia's stoicism holds true to this day. At first you cannot tell anything about her. You do not realize who she is. She has put a sort of shield around herself, but she is a very brave and faithful woman. In 1977, John David Steer made a cameo appearance in Nash's life. Father and son had been in touch by letter at least since 1971, John David's senior year in high school. Nash had become quite concerned about his son's college plans, and Alicia had written Arthur Maddock to ask him to advise John David. John David enrolled at Bunker Hill Community College and supported himself by working as an orderly. 4 years later, he applied to a number of four-year schools, was offered several scholarships, and in 1976 transferred to Amherst, one of the most elite liberal arts colleges in the country. That fall, Norton Starr, a professor of mathematics at Amherst, hired a student to do some yard work for him. Afterwards, Starr invited him into the house for a cold drink. As they chatted, the young man learned that Starr had done his Ph.D. at MIT. Had he known a mathematician there named John Nash? Only by sight and reputation, Starr replied. He's my father, the young man said. Starr looked at him searchingly. He looked at the young man again. My God, you do look just like him, he said. Shortly afterward, John David drove down to Princeton to visit his father. Alicia was friendly. He met his brother Johnny for the first time. The following Christmas, Johnny came up to Boston to stay with Eleanor and John David. Eleanor welcomed him warmly, cooked him nice meals, fussed over him. He came without a winter coat, so Eleanor bought him a down jacket. Johnny was well behaved around his older brother, but could turn nasty when he was alone with her. At the end of the holiday, Eleanor recalled, he didn't want to let John go, so John took him back to school with him. The reunion between Nash and John Steer did not lead to a lasting reconciliation. It just sort of petered out, John Steer recalled. His father was more interested in talking about his own problems than his son's. When I asked him for advice, he answered with something about Nixon, he said. Nash's confidences were unsettling. Nash had some idea that his son, having attained his majority, would play an essential and significant personal role in my personal, long-awaited gay liberation. He had waited a long time, as he said at the time, to tell him about my life and problems and life history. Eleanor Steer recalled that he did so. John David eventually stopped returning his father's calls. The two would not meet again for 17 years. I haven't always wanted to have contact with him, John David said. Having a mentally ill father was rather disturbing. More often than commonly realized, schizophrenia can be an episodic illness, especially in the years following its initial onset. Periods of acute psychosis may be interspersed with periods of relative calm, in which symptoms diminish dramatically, either as a result of treatment or spontaneously. This was the pattern for Johnny. In 1979, on the first day of the fall semester at Ryder College in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, Kenneth Fields, the chairman of the mathematics department, was asked to talk with a freshman who had made a pest of himself at the math orientation session, questioning everything and protesting that the presentation was not rigorous enough. I don't need to take calculus, the young man said when he arrived in Fields' office. I'm going to major in math. Since Ryder rarely attracted students with an interest or background in mathematics, Fields was intrigued. Quizzing the student as they walked around the campus, he quickly concluded that no mathematics course at Ryder was advanced enough for this young man and offered to tutor him personally. By the way, what's your name? He finally asked. John Nash, the student replied. Seeing Fields' look of astonishment, he added, You may have heard of my father. He solved the embedding theorem. For Fields, who had been an undergraduate at MIT in the 1960s and was familiar with the Nash legend, it was an amazing moment. Fields proceeded to meet with Johnny weekly. Johnny took a while to buckle down, but he was soon plowing through difficult texts in linear algebra, advanced calculus, and differential geometry. It was obvious that he was a real mathematician, said Fields. He was also bright and friendly, a fundamentalist Christian who made friends with other religious, intellectually precocious students. He talked to Fields, who has several relatives who suffer from schizophrenia, about his mental illness. Occasionally he would do a riff on extraterrestrials, and on one occasion he threatened a history professor. By and large, said Fields, Johnny's symptoms seemed to be under control. He got straight A's and won an academic prize in his sophomore year. Field soon concluded that Johnny was wasting his time at Rider and belonged in a Ph.D. program. In 1981, despite of his lack of a high school or college diploma, Johnny was accepted at Rutgers University with a full scholarship. Once there, he breezed through his qualifying examinations. From time to time, he would threaten to drop out of school, and Fields would get frantic calls from Alicia begging him to talk to Johnny. When Fields did, Johnny would answer, "Why do I have to do anything? My father doesn't have to do anything. My mother supports him. Why can't she support me?" But he didn't drop out. He succeeded brilliantly. Melvin Nathanson, then a professor of mathematics at Rutgers, liked to assign what he called simple versions of unsolved classical problems in his graduate course on number theory. "I gave one the first week," he recalled. "Johnny came back with the solution the following week. I gave another one that week, and a week later he had that solution, too. It was extraordinary." Johnny wrote a joint paper with Nathanson that became the first chapter of his dissertation. He then wrote a second paper on his own, which Nathanson called Beautiful, and which also became part of the thesis. His third paper was an important generalization of a theorem proved by Paul Erdos in the 1930s for a special case of so-called B-sequences. Neither Erdos nor anyone else had succeeded in proving that the theorem held for other sequences, and Johnny's successful attack on the problem would generate a flurry of papers by other number theorists. "When Johnny got his Ph.D. from Rutgers in 1985, said Nathanson, he seemed poised for a long and productive career as a first-rate research mathematician. An offer of a one-year instructorship at Marshall University in West Virginia seemed like the first of the usual steps that eventually carry new mathematics PhDs to tenured positions somewhere in academia. While Johnny was in graduate school, Alicia Lardy returned to El Salvador for good, and Alicia Nash moved to a job as a computer programmer at New Jersey Transit in Newark. Things seemed rather hopeful." Part 5. The Most Worthy. Chapter 47. Remission. As you know, he has had his illness, but right now he's fine. It's not attributable to one or several things. It's just a question of living a quiet life. Alicia Nash, 1994. Peter Sarnak, a brash 35-year-old number theorist whose primary interest is the Riemann hypothesis, joined the Princeton faculty in the fall of 1990. He had just given a seminar. The tall, thin, white-haired man who had been sitting in the back asked for a copy of Sarnak's paper after the crowd had dispersed. Sarnak, who had been a student of Paul Cohen's at Stanford, knew Nash by reputation as well as by sight, naturally. Having been told many times Nash was completely mad, he wanted to be kind. He promised to send Nash the paper. A few days later, at tea time, Nash approached him again. He had a few questions, he said, avoiding looking Sarnak in the face. At first, Sarnak just listened politely, but within a few minutes, Sarnak found himself having to concentrate quite hard. Later, as he turned the conversation over in his mind, he felt rather astonished. Nash had spotted a real problem in one of Sarnak's arguments. What's more, he also suggested a way around it. "The way he views things is very different from other people," Sarnak said later. "He comes up with instant insights I don't know I'd ever get to." "Very, very outstanding insights, very unusual insights." They talked from time to time. After each conversation, Nash would disappear for a few days and then return with a sheaf of computer printouts. Nash was obviously very, very good with the computer. He would think up some miniature problem, usually very ingeniously, and then play with it. If something worked on a small scale in his head, Sarnak realized, Nash would go to the computer to try to find out if it was also true the next few hundred thousand times. What really bowled Sarnak over, though, was that Nash seemed perfectly rational, a far cry from the supposedly demented man he had heard other mathematicians describe. Sarnak was more than a little outraged. Here was this giant, and he'd been all but forgotten by the mathematics profession, and the justification for the neglect was obviously no longer valid, if it had ever been. That was 1990. In retrospect, it is impossible to say exactly when Nash's miraculous remission, which began to be noted by mathematicians around Princeton roughly at the beginning of this decade, really began. But in contrast to the onset of his illness, which became full-blown in a matter of months, the remission took place over a period of years. It was, by his own account, a slow evolution, a gradual tapering off in the 1970s and 1980s. Hale Trotter, who saw Nash nearly every day in the computer center during those years, confirms this. My impression was of a very gradual sort of improvement. In the early stages, he was making up numbers out of names and being worried by what he found. Gradually, that went away. Then it was more mathematical numerology, playing with formulas and factoring. It wasn't coherent math research, but it had lost its bizarre quality. Later, it was real research. As early as 1983, Nash was beginning to come out of his shell and making friends with students. Mark Doody, a graduate student in economics, sought Nash out in 1983. I felt bold enough at the time to want to meet this legend. He discovered that he and Nash shared an interest in the stock market. We'd be walking along Nassau Street and we'd be talking about the market, Doody recalled. Nash struck Doody as a stock picker, and on occasion Doody followed his advice, with less than stellar results, it must be said. The following year, when Doody was working on his thesis and was unable to solve the model he wanted to use, Nash helped to bail him out. The calculation of an infinite product was involved, Doody recalled. I was unable to do it, so I showed it to Nash. He suggested I use Stirling's formula to compute the product, and then he wrote down a few lines of equations to indicate how this should be done. All during this time, Nash struck Doody as no odder than other mathematicians he had encountered. By 1985, Daniel Feinberg, who had helped Nash factor a number derived from Rockefeller's name a decade earlier, and was now a visiting professor at Princeton, had lunch with Nash. He was deeply struck by the change he saw in Nash. He seemed so much better. He described his work in the theory of prime numbers. I'm not competent to judge, but it seemed like real mathematics, like real research. That was very gratifying. The changes were, for the most part, visible only to a few. Edward G. Nilges, a programmer who worked in Princeton University's Computer Center from 1987 to 1992, recalled that Nash acted frightened and silent at first. In Nilges's last year or two in Princeton, however, Nash was asking him questions about the Internet and about programs he was working on. Nilges was impressed. Nash's computer programs were startlingly elegant. And in 1992, when Shapley visited Princeton, he and Nash had lunch and were able for the first time in many, many years to have quite an enjoyable conversation. Nash was quite sharp then, Shapley recalled. He was free of this distraction. He'd learned how to use the computer. He was working on the Big Bang. I was very pleased. That Nash, after so many years of severe illness, was now within the normal range for the mathematical personality, raises a great many questions. Had Nash really recovered? How rare is such a recovery? Did the recovery indicate he had never really had schizophrenia, which, as everyone knows, is incurable? Were his psychotic episodes in the late 1950s through the 1970s really symptoms of bipolar illness, which is generally less debilitating and carries better odds of recovery? Absent a re-diagnosis based on Nash's psychiatric records, no absolutely definitive answer is possible. Psychotic symptoms alone, psychiatrists now agree, do not a schizophrenic make. And distinguishing between schizophrenia and bipolar illness when symptoms first appear remains difficult even with today's more precise diagnostic criteria. Nonetheless, there are strong reasons for believing that Nash's initial diagnosis was in fact correct, and that he is one of a very small number of individuals who suffered a long and severe course of schizophrenia to experience a dramatic remission. The fact that Nash's younger son has also been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder is strong evidence that Nash himself had schizophrenia, in contrast to the Freudian theories popular in the 1950s when Nash was first diagnosed. Schizophrenia is now thought to have a strong genetic component. The duration and severity of Nash's symptoms, his inability to do work that was prior to and since his illness the principal passion of his life, and his withdrawal from most human contact is also powerful evidence. Moreover, Nash has described his illness not in terms of highs and lows, bouts of mania followed by disabling depression, but rather in terms of a persistent dreamlike state and bizarre beliefs in terms not dissimilar to those used by other people with schizophrenia. He has spoken of being preoccupied with delusions, of being unable to work, and of withdrawing from the people around him. Mostly, however, he has defined it as an inability to reason. Indeed, he has told Harold Kuhn and the others that he is still plagued by paranoid thoughts, even voices, although in comparison to the past, the noise level has been turned way down. Nash has compared rationality to dieting, implying a constant conscious struggle. It is a matter of policing one's thoughts, he has said, trying to recognize paranoid ideas and rejecting them, just the way somebody who wants to lose weight has to decide consciously to avoid fats or sweets. While psychiatry has made progress in defining disease, definitions of recovery remain controversial. The absence of obvious symptoms, as George Winokur and Min Swong wrote, does not necessarily mean that individuals are well, since they still may be suffering from a defect state that is stabilized and with which they have now learned to cope. But such an assessment, possibly appropriate to Nash's state in the late 1970s and early 1980s, seems overly pessimistic now. Both the perceptions of those who know Nash and his own indicate a more expansive, far-reaching change. "John is definitely recovered," said Kenneth Fields of Ryder College, who has known Nash since the late 1970s and has had a great deal of first-hand experience with people who suffer from schizophrenia. It would be more accurate to describe Nash's recovery as a remission, and it turns out the remission, though miraculous, is not unique. Until a few years ago, nobody knew much about the life history of people with schizophrenia. The only studies dated to the 1970s and were done by psychiatrists who worked at state hospitals. Since the only older people who were still there to be studied were still sick enough to require constant hospitalization, schizophrenia was viewed as a degenerative disease. Its assault on the brain was thought to continue, more or less evenly, until death. Manfred Bleuler, a German psychiatrist, was the first researcher to systematically challenge this view. In a 20-year follow-up of more than 200 patients, he found 20% fully recovered. Moreover, he concluded that long-lasting recoveries did not result from treatment, and hence appeared to be spontaneous. Then a German team at the University of Bonn did a long-term follow-up of patients who had been admitted to one of the city's psychiatric hospitals during the late 1940s and early 1950s. Going back to the records, they reviewed the diagnosis of schizophrenia and chose only patients whose histories and symptoms were consistent with modern definitions of the disease. There were about 500. Then they located the people or their families, and through interviews with the patients and people who knew them, created detailed portraits of what had happened to them. Many, about a quarter, had died, mostly suicides. Some were still institutionalized, apparently unresponsive to any drugs or to electroshock treatment, which was used far more extensively than in the United States. Another group was living with their families but still had symptoms, especially the negative symptoms of lethargy, lack of drive, and lack of interest and pleasure in life. But a surprisingly large group, perhaps a quarter, seemed to be symptom-free, living independently with a circle of friends and jobs in the professions for which they had been trained or had held before they got sick. Most of these had not been under the care of a physician for years. The researchers were extremely surprised, as news of the study results spread through the small global community of schizophrenia researchers. A team in the United States at the University of Vermont decided to undertake a similar long-term study. Despite their initial skepticism, their results were remarkably similar. 10 years after the disease struck, most patients were still extremely sick. 30 years later, however, a significant minority were leading fairly normal lives. Only about 5% conformed completely to the backward image. Most of those who committed suicide, it turned out, did so in the first 10 years of the disease. These appeared to be people who got well enough between acute episodes to appreciate the awfulness of what lay ahead of them and succumbed to despair. And most of the damage to thinking and emotion from the disease seemed to occur in those years as well. After that, the symptoms seemed to level out. Subsequent research has somewhat tempered these optimistic conclusions. All long-term studies are plagued with uncertainties about diagnoses and by differences over what constitutes recovery. A study by Winokur and Zhuang of 170 patients, perhaps the most rigorous, found that 30 years after the onset of the illness, just 8% could be considered well. Thus, while Nash's dramatic recovery is not unique, it is relatively rare. While none of the studies was able to pinpoint factors that favored recovery, they suggest that someone with Nash's history prior to the onset of his illness, high social class, high IQ, high achievement, with no schizophrenic relatives, who gets the disease relatively late in the third decade, who experiences very acute symptoms early and gets sick at the time of some great life change, has the best chance of remission. On the other hand, young men like Nash, for whom the contrast between early achievement and the state to which they are reduced by the disease is greatest, are also most likely to commit suicide. Since suicides are relatively rare for hospitalized patients, Martha may have saved Nash's life by insisting during the 1960s that he be hospitalized. Whether or not insulin shock and antipsychotic drugs, which apparently produced the temporary remissions Nash experienced in the first half of the 1960s, increased the odds of a remission later in life is unclear. While a larger number of patients who got sick during the 1950s, when antipsychotic drugs became available on a wide scale, were among those who were symptom-free in late middle age, early treatment with drugs wasn't a particularly accurate indicator of what would happen later. At the same time, Nash's refusal to take the antipsychotic drugs after 1970, and indeed during most of the periods when he wasn't in the hospital during the 1960s, may have been fortuitous. Taken regularly, such drugs, in a high percentage of cases, produce horrible, persistent symptoms like tardive dyskinesia, stiffening of head and neck muscles and involuntary movements, including of the tongue, and a mental fog, all of which would have made his gentle re-entry into the world of mathematics a near impossibility. Nash's remission did not come about, as many people later assumed, because of some new treatment. "I emerged from irrational thinking," he said in 1996, "ultimately without medicine other than the natural hormonal changes of aging." He described the process as one that involved both a growing awareness of the sterility of his delusional state and a growing capacity for rejecting delusional thought. He wrote in 1995, "Gradually I began to intellectually reject some of the delusionally influenced lines of thinking which had been characteristic of my orientation. This began most recognizably with the rejection of politically oriented thinking as essentially a hopeless waste of intellectual effort." He believes, rightly or wrongly, that he willed his own recovery. Actually, it can be analogous to the role of willpower in effectively dieting. If one makes an effort to rationalize one's thinking, when one can simply recognize and reject the irrational hypotheses of delusional thinking. A key step was a resolution not to concern myself in politics relative to my secret world because it was ineffectual, he wrote in his Nobel autobiography. This in turn led me to renounce anything relative to religious issues or teaching or intending to teach. I began to study mathematical problems and to learn the computer as it existed at the time. I was helped by mathematicians who got me computer time. By the late 1980s, Nash's name was appearing in the titles of dozens of articles in leading economics journals. But Nash himself remained in obscurity. Many younger researchers, of course, simply assumed he was dead. Others thought that he was languishing in a mental hospital, or had heard that he had a lobotomy. Even the best informed saw him, for the most part, as a sort of ghost. In particular, with the exception of the 1978 von Neumann Prize, the result of Lloyd Shapley's efforts, the recognition and honors routinely accorded scholars of his stature simply failed to materialize. One particularly egregious episode in the academic year 1987-88 illustrated just how powerfully the perceptions of Nash's mental illness worked to reinforce his marginalized status, even in the field, economics, that he had helped to revolutionize. Being elected a fellow in the Econometric Society is, as one former president of the society put it, tantamount to getting one's membership card in the club of bona fide economic theorists. By 1987, there were some 350 living fellows, including every past and future Nobel laureate to date, but Douglas North, presumably excluded because he is an economic historian, not a mathematical economist, as well as every leading contributor to game theory, Kuhn, Shapley, Shubik, Aumann, Harzanyi, Zeltan, and so forth, but not Nash. In late 1988, Ariel Rubinstein, a recently elected fellow, was surprised to discover this historic mistake, and promptly nominated Nash. The nomination came too late for the November 1989 election. Further, the Society's bylaws required any candidate proposed by a sole sponsor to pass muster with the Society's five-member nominating committee, one of whose main tasks was in any case to determine whether previous nominating committees had overlooked people, and to correct such oversights. As a result, the nomination was forwarded to the committee, which took it up in the spring of 1989. By then, Rubinstein, a game theorist who holds professorships at the University of Tel Aviv and Princeton University, was a member of the committee. The other members, all professors of economics, were Mervyn King at the London School of Economics, also a vice chairman of the Bank of England, Beth Allen at the University of Minnesota, Gary Chamberlain at Harvard, and Truman Bewley at Yale. The proposal to put Nash on the ballot sparked an intense controversy between Rubinstein and the rest of the committee, one that dragged on for months. From the start, the issue was Nash's mental illness. Mervyn King said in 1996, "People felt in some vague sense this was relevant." Other committee members pointed out that Nash had no recent publications, and was not even a member of the society, and was unlikely to participate actively if elected. At one point, Truman Bewley, the committee's chairman, wrote to Rubinstein, "I doubt Nash would be elected, since he is well known to have been crazy for years," dismissing the nomination as frivolous. When Rubinstein refused to back down, Bewley asked him to find out more about the current status of Nash's health. After Rubinstein objected that no other candidates were being similarly investigated, Bewley made his own inquiries, calling, among others, his colleague at Yale, Martin Shubik, who had known Nash in graduate school and had received some of Nash's mad letters. Bewley reported back to the committee, "Regarding Nash, I inquired and learned that he is still crazy. Fellowship is an activity, more than a reward for past work. The fellows are the ultimate governing body of the Econometric Society." In June, the committee voted 4-1 to keep Nash off the November 1989 ballot. Rubinstein was the sole dissenter. Beth Allen recalled, "People were asked to give a rank ordering. Nash didn't make it. Ariel had a fit. He insisted Nash be put on the ballot anyway." Bewley made it clear that the matter was closed, a decision he later regretted. "It was the wrong decision," he said in 1996. The episode is reminiscent of the Institute for Advanced Studies' refusal for many years to grant a mathematics professorship to the world-renowned logician Kurt Gödel. But in that case, there was considerably more justification, since the Institute's tiny mathematics faculty feared that Gödel's well-known paranoia and terror of decision-making would hamstring its ability to conduct business, which included the selection of each year's visiting scholars. The crowning irony of this affair is that when Nash did get on the ballot in the election for 1990, because Rubinstein circumvented the nominating committee by submitting a joint nomination with Kenneth Binmore at the University of Michigan and Roger Meyerson at Northwestern University, he received, according to the secretary of the society, Julie Gordon, the overwhelming majority of the votes. Chapter 48, The Prize. You will have to wait to find out the story of Nash's prize in 50 years. We will never reveal it. Carl Olaf Jakobsen, Secretary General, Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, February 1997. It is Tuesday, October 12, 1994. Jörgen Weibel, a personable young professor of economics, looks at his watch for perhaps the 50th time. He is standing near the front of the massive sessions hall of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, a jewel box of a room with a heavily ornamented ceiling and portrait-lined walls, which at the moment is crowded with reporters and camera crews, jammed in narrow aisles between the U-shaped tables. Near pandemonium reigns. Everybody is milling around, speculating in loud voices about the delay. Weibel had been so elated when he left his office at the University of Stockholm that mid-morning that he half-walked, half-ran through the highway underpass and up the hill to the academy half a mile away. Assar Lindbeck, the chairman of the prize committee, had asked him if he wouldn't mind being on hand to answer questions at the press conference. Quite an honor. But now Weibel's mouth feels dry, his shoulders ache, and he can feel the first twinges of a headache as he tries to imagine what has gone wrong. The Nobel press conference had as usual been called for 11:30. These staid, heavily scripted events are always held right after the final ceremonial vote, and always start on time. But it is 1 o'clock and there is no sign of any Academy officials and no word either. All the reporters are saying that nothing like this has ever happened before. Suddenly the enormous doors to his left swing open, and a small knot of Academy officials burst into the hall, all wearing slightly dazed expressions, like moviegoers stepping out of a theater into daylight. They hurry past the milling, shouting throng, ignoring the questions, brushing aside the demands for explanations, but Weibel, who is standing near the table with the microphones, manages to catch Lindbeck's eye for a fraction of a second. The relief is overwhelming. Lindbeck didn't signal or anything like that, he said later, but I saw right away that everything had turned out all right. And the relief turns into something like joy when he listens to Carl Olaf Jacobsen, the Academy's handsome silver-haired Secretary General, read the first few words of the press release. John Forbes Nash, Jr., of Princeton, New Jersey. The behind-the-scenes saga of John Nash's Nobel Prize is almost as extraordinary as the fact that the mathematician became a laureate at all. For years after the idea of a prize for game theory was first considered, even Nash's most ardent admirers considered the likelihood of his winning impossibly remote. But much later, when the prize was virtually his, after he had been told that he had won it, and within an hour of the official notification, the ne plus ultra of honors very nearly eluded him, with far-reaching consequences for the future of the economics prize itself. This previously untold story is one that the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences and the Nobel Foundation, intent on preserving the Olympian aura that surrounds the prizes, have tried very hard to keep under wraps. The Academy is one of the most secretive of societies, and all details, the nominations, inquiries, deliberations, and votes of the lengthy selection process, are among the most closely guarded secrets in the world. The very statutes of the prize demand it. Proposals received for the award of a prize, and investigations and opinions concerning the award of a prize, may not be divulged. Should divergent opinions have been expressed in connection with the decision of the prize-winning body concerning the award of the prize, these may not be included in the record or otherwise divulged. A prize-winning body may, however, after due consideration of each individual case, permit access to material which formed the basis for evaluation and decision concerning a prize for purposes of historical research. Such permission may not be granted until at least 50 years have elapsed after the date on which the decision in question was taken. There have been breaches, of course. In the 1960s and 1970s, advance rumors of the literature laureates used to trickle out of the Academy of Arts and Letters with notorious regularity. In 1995, a member of the Norwegian Nobel Committee quit over the impending peace prize to the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and took his protest to the media. Michael Solman, the executive director of the Nobel Foundation, still sounds furious when he recounts the incident. But few, if any, cracks have appeared, figuratively or otherwise, in the gray Beaux-Arts walls of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, guardian of the physics, chemistry, and economics prizes. If not for the mysterious 1.5-hour delay on the day that the Nash Prize was announced, the Academy might well have succeeded in protecting the secrecy of the process. As it was, Academy officials not only refused to explain the delay, but denied that it was in any way significant. Indeed, they very quickly began to assert that it had never happened. Recently, Carl-Göran Mailer, a member of the Economics Prize Committee in 1994 and privy to all of the events that transpired, said, "I do not recall any delay." The prize in economics is something of a stepchild. Alfred Nobel, the Swedish industrialist and inventor, did not have the dismal science in mind when he wrote his famous 1894 will creating Nobel Prizes in physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace. The economics prize was not created until nearly 70 years later, the brainchild of the then head of the Swedish Central Bank. The prize is financed by the bank and administered by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences and the Nobel Foundation. It is not, in fact, a Nobel Prize, but rather the Central Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Science in memory of Alfred Nobel. To the public, that is a distinction without much of a difference. The early winners of the Economics Prize, among them Paul Samuelson, Kenneth Arrow, and Gunnar Myrdal, were generally acknowledged to be intellectual giants, and lent their distinction to the prize. And so far, at least, it has become the ultimate symbol of excellence for scientists and laymen alike, and does in fact make economics Nobelists life peers in the world community of scholars. The criteria, rules, and procedures for the Economics Prize are patterned after those that apply to the science prizes. Candidates must be living. No more than three can share a prize, which is less of a problem in economics than in physical science, where teamwork is more the norm. Though many people, even those who participate in the nominating process, have failed to appreciate it, the Nobel is not a prize for outstanding individuals, nor is it a lifetime achievement award. The prize is awarded for specific achievements, inventions, and discoveries. These can be theories, analytical methods, or purely empirical results. As in physics, in which mathematics plays as big a role as in economics, there is a strong bias against prizes for only mathematics. Nobel himself is said to have hated mathematicians, though some of the best stories about why, revolving around sexual and professional jealousy, turn out to have been apocryphal. The prize selection process is also virtually identical to the cycles for the science prizes. A 5-member prize committee, composed of senior Swedish economists, gathers nominations and referees reports from elite academics around the world. The committee makes its choice every spring, usually in April. The so-called social sciences class, all academy members in economics and other social sciences, endorses the candidate or candidates in early fall, usually late August or early September, and the academy votes on the nominees in early October, on the day that the winner or winners are announced. On paper, at least, all the members of the prize committee are as distinguished as the candidates, and the selection of winners is a detached, disinterested, and ultimately democratic exercise in scientific judgment. As divorced from personal likes and dislikes, prejudices, or political and pecuniary considerations, as the business of determining the winners in a sports tournament, there is some, even a good deal, of truth in this idealized description of what actually goes on, but it is not anything like the whole story. Assar Lindbeck, who joined the prize committee in 1969 and became its chairman in 1980, has dominated the economic selections for the entire history of the Nobel Prize. Tall, red-haired, powerfully built, he looks like the boss of a machine tool shop or a mine. He is from the far north of Sweden, a little crude, a little uptight, more than a little brusque. He has opinions, strong ones, about nearly all topics that engage his lively mind, and as a result is quite unpopular in the academy. But he is not without a certain earthy charm. His sense of humor is sly and dry. He is a Sunday painter, showing up at prize committee meetings with paint spatters on his horn-rimmed glasses. A large and extremely graphic, erotic painting hangs in his office at the university. Lindbeck is Sweden's most important economist. Top academic economists in Sweden, where academia, government, and industry have long been closely entwined, have traditionally wielded a great deal more political power than their American counterparts. Bertil Ohlin, the committee's first chairman, was for years the leader of Sweden's opposition. Gunnar Myrdal, who won the prize in 1974, was a minister in the Social Democratic government. Lindbeck himself was a protege of Prime Minister Olaf Palme, has held many political advisory posts, and has been involved in most public policy debates since the 1960s. Unlike Ohlin and Myrdal, Lindbeck never abandoned his research career to become a full-time politician. Indeed, he is generally considered a likely contender for a Nobel himself. Even today, at age 68, there is a small assembly line on the shelves behind his desk at the University of Stockholm, impressively large piles of paper marked Articles Under Preparation, Articles Submitted, and Articles Accepted. And he has used his political savvy and prestige to build up economics departments and research institutes. "He's kind of a mafia leader, a fixer," said Carl Gustav Lofgren, an adjunct member of the Economics Prize Committee and a professor of resource economics at the University of Umeå. He adds, "I never did any resource economics, but I became a professor of resource economics. Lindbeck has good ideas about who to move here and there. He listens. He has his own opinions. I like him. He's a very sound guy, very smart." Lindbeck has a reputation for getting his way. His style is that of a central banker rather than a chief executive officer. As his longtime friend Mailer put it, "Asser never controlled with commands." In an article Lindbeck wrote on the Economic Prize in the mid-1980s, he bragged, "So far, the proposals of the prize committee to the Academy have been unanimous. A consensus has in fact developed quite automatically within the committee, as if by some kind of invisible hand, after intensive discussions." The invisible hand, of course, was his own. "You could put it that way," said Lofgren, laughing. "You can say it's unanimous, but he's a dominating person. We don't vote officially. You agree." Kirsten Fredga, the president of the Swedish Academy of Sciences, said at one point, "Very few people have ever dared say no to Asser." Ironically, by December 1994, when Fredga made the remark, it was no longer true. John Nash's name first appeared as a candidate for a Nobel in the mid-1980s. The Nobel selection process is like a giant funnel. At any given time, the Economics Prize Committee has a dozen investigations running of fields and clusters of possible candidates. But fairly quickly, the focus shifts to the hottest fields and candidates. By 1984, the obvious Nobels had been handed out to the likes of Samuelson, Arrow, and James Tobin. The committee was looking further afield, among newer branches of economics, and nothing was newer or hotter at that particular moment than game theory. In 1984, the prize committee contacted a young researcher at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. A combat veteran and an activist in Israel's peace movement, Ariel Rubinstein took months to write a painstaking 10-page report on potential candidates for a prize in game theory. He placed Nash at the top of the list. The 1982 paper that established Rubinstein as one of the leading researchers in game theory was an extension of Nash's 1950 bargaining paper. Rubinstein's sense of indebtedness to Nash and his appreciation for Nash's original achievement was thus very vivid. Having encountered Nash on a visit to Princeton, Rubinstein also could not help but be struck by the stark contrast between Nash's past contributions and his current circumstances. His outrage was fueled partly by a first-hand encounter with the stigma of mental illness. His mother was once hospitalized for depression, and Rubinstein never forgot the lack of basic human respect accorded her by doctors and relatives. The Nobel Prize Committee did not take up the matter again until 1987, when it commissioned a second report, this time from Weibull. After he submitted it, Lindbeck told him that the committee wanted to ask him some questions and asked him to attend a couple of committee meetings at the Royal Academy. Weibull was, of course, pledged to complete secrecy. When Weibull walked into the paneled room, introductions were hardly necessary. As a member of Sweden's small academic elite, Weibull already knew the five men, mostly academics, sitting around the enormous table. He was nonetheless slightly awed, realizing from the committee's questions that he was being given the opportunity to participate in the earliest stage of a historic decision. "My impression was that it was the first time that the committee had met to consider this." Weibull presented a verbal summary of his report, telling the committee about the central ideas in game theory, their importance for economic research, and the key contributors. He too had placed Nash at the top of his list of half a dozen seminal thinkers. The committee's questions were carefully phrased to hide the members' own opinions, and focused in the first session on whether game theory was just a fad or really an important tool for investigating a wide range of interesting economic problems. By the second meeting, however, Lynn Beck, the committee chairman, zeroed in on Nash. Was what Nash did merely mathematics? Lynn Beck asked. Did he simply formalize ideas that economists had formulated at least 100 years earlier? Was it true that Nash had stopped doing research in game theory in the early 1950s? That question was the closest anyone came to mentioning the subject of Nash's mental illness. When Weibel left the meeting, he thought that there was a good chance that the committee would eventually agree to award a prize in game theory, but he had no reason, given Nash's illness and the decades that had passed since his early papers, to believe that Nash would make the cut. Eric Fisher, a visitor at Stockholm University's Institute for International Economics that year, recalled being quizzed by Asser Lindbeck about Nash's mental state. Fisher had been an undergraduate at Princeton, where he used to see Nash hanging out in the foyer of Firestone Library. Lindbeck wanted to know whether Nash was competent enough to handle the publicity that winning a Nobel might entail. It was 2 years later, the fall of 1989, that Weibel hurried across the Princeton University campus to meet Nash for the first time. After weeks of delicate negotiation, with the chairman of the mathematics department acting as a go-between, the elusive mathematician had finally agreed to have lunch. Weibel had a specific motive for the meeting. Lindbeck had pulled him aside shortly before his departure from Sweden and asked him to report back to him on Nash's mental state. There was some talk, Lindbeck said, that Nash had some sort of remission and was behaving quite reasonably. Was it true? Weibel was about to find out. Weibel knew instantly that the tall, white-haired, frail-looking man standing in the driveway in front of Prospect House, Princeton's Florentine faculty club, was Nash. He was standing there rather awkwardly, smoking, looking down at the ground, obviously dressed up for the occasion, wearing white tennis shoes, but also a long-sleeved dress shirt and dress pants. As Weibel drew nearer, he could see that Nash was deathly nervous. When Weibel gave him his ready, friendly smile and extended his hand, Nash was unable to meet his eye, and after the briefest of handshakes, instantly put his hand back into his pocket. They ate not in the main formal restaurant, but downstairs in a small cafeteria. Weibel, a gentle, soft-spoken man, asked Nash questions about his work. Sometimes the conversation took odd turns. When Weibel asked Nash about refining the Nash equilibrium concept by perhaps taking into account irrational moves by players, Nash answered him by talking not about irrationality, but about immortality. But on the whole, Nash struck Weibel as no more eccentric, irrational, or paranoid than many other academics. Weibel learned interesting details about Nash's game theory papers that he hadn't known. Nash had gotten his idea for the bargaining solution as an undergraduate at Carnegie Tech by thinking about trade agreements between nations. While he had used both Brouwer's and Kakutani's fixed-point theorems to prove his equilibrium result, he still thought that the proof relying on Brouwer was both more beautiful and more apt. He said that von Neumann had opposed his idea of equilibrium, but that Tucker had supported him. Afterward, though, what stood out for Weibel about the meeting, and the thing that transformed him that day from a detached observer and objective informant into an ardent advocate, was something Nash said before they walked into the club. "Can I go in?" Nash had asked uncertainly. "I'm not faculty." That this great, great man did not feel that he had a right to eat in the faculty club struck Weibel as an injustice that demanded remedy. By the summer of 1993, rumors about a possible prize in game theory were rampant. A very small, very select symposium on game theory had taken place in mid-June at what used to be Alfred Nobel's old dynamite factory in Björkborn, a few hundred kilometers north of Stockholm. Such symposia, sponsored by the prize committee, are invariably seen as Nobel beauty contests. This one was organized by Karl-Göran Mailer, with the help of Jorgen Weibel and the Cambridge economist Partha Dasgupta. Lindbeck, who was spending the spring term in Cambridge, oversaw the preparations by telephone. The dozen or so invited speakers represented two generations of leading game theory researchers, mostly theorists and experimentalists. Among them, John Harzanyi, Reinhard Selten, Robert Aumann, David Krepps, Ariel Rubinstein, Al Roth, Paul Milgram, and Eric Maskin. The topic? Rationality and Equilibrium in Strategic Interaction. Most of the participants took it for granted that they were performing for the benefit of the prize committee and assumed that the three graybeards in the group, Harzanyi, Zeltan, and Aumann, were the likely laureates. Aumann, the white-bearded Israeli dean of game theory, was strutting around as if he had already won. Much was made of the choice of topic, which was theoretical and focused on non-cooperative as opposed to cooperative games, and those who hadn't been invited. Nash, most obviously, of course. As it turned out, the prize committee was far from committing itself to a candidate. Protestations that the main motivation for the symposium was to create an opportunity for the committee to educate itself, as Torsten Persson of the prize committee put it later, were accurate. Only one other prize committee member besides Mailer was even there, and that was Ingemar Stahl. His brother Ingolf was one of the speakers, and Ingemar intimated that he had come to hear him, but everyone assumed that he was there to act as a spy for the committee. A few weeks later, Harold Kuhn, the professor of mathematics and economics at Princeton University, got an urgent fax from Stockholm. It was from Weibel, who wanted Kuhn to send a number of documents, among them Nash's PhD thesis and a Rand memorandum, no later than mid-August, please. Weibel also asked Kuhn to get him a transcript of an interview with Nash conducted by Robert Leonard, the historian. Leonard, who had not taped the interview, wrote Kuhn a note in which he said that the request sent my mind reeling in the Swedish direction. In Stockholm, meanwhile, the prize committee was about to report to the so-called ninth class of the academy, all the academy members in the social sciences. The bulk of the report, of course, was devoted to the proposed candidates for 1993. Two economics historians, Robert Fogel of the University of Chicago and Douglas North of Washington University in St. Louis. But the committee also updated the class on two or three other proposals that constituted the top choices for subsequent prizes. One of them was a prize in game theory. Nash was on the short list of half a dozen candidates. Nearly the only point the prize committee had agreed on was that it wanted to go ahead with a prize in game theory in 1994, the 50th anniversary of John von Neumann and Oscar Morgenstern's great opus. Lindbeck and the others were still toying with every possible configuration of two and three winners. The short list, the candidates that the committee had focused most of its attention on, had scarcely changed since the prize was first conceived. Apart from Nash, it included Lloyd Shapley, whom Nash had known as a graduate student at Princeton. Shapley was the most direct intellectual descendant of von Neumann and Morgenstern, and the clear leader of the field in the 1950s and 1960s, when most of the work was in cooperative theory. Reinhard Zeltan and John Harzanyi, who had elaborated the theory of non-cooperative games, were also on it. Harzanyi's breakthroughs permitted analysis of games of incomplete information, while Zeltan developed a way to discriminate between reasonable and unreasonable outcomes in games. Aumann, who developed the role of common knowledge in games, was also on the list. And Thomas Schelling, who invented the notion of the strategic value of brinkmanship, was being considered because of his broad vision for the application of game theory to the social sciences. The prize decision is made in stages. Each year, the committee starts meeting soon after the January 31st deadline for the 200 or so nominations that the committee solicits from prominent economists around the world. By April, the committee decides on a particular candidate or candidates. In late August, it submits the proposal, along with a document several inches thick that includes the referee reports, publications, and other supporting material, to the ninth class for endorsement. The Academy then votes on the candidates in early October. But as everyone involved was well aware, the power truly resides in the committee, and until recently in one man, Asser Lindbeck. Lofgren said, "The prize committee meets for a whole year, It's technically impossible for the higher body to make the decision. Debate in the committee was unusually contentious from the first meeting, attended by Lindbeck, Mailer, Stahl, Persson, and Lars Svensson. Lindbeck had come to the conclusion that the prize should be for contributions to non-cooperative theory alone. These were the ideas that had proved fruitful for economics, the most important so far, as Lindbeck later said, adding, "Cooperative theory has a few interesting applications in economics, but perhaps more in political science." Although Mailer sided with Lindbeck from the start, convincing the rest of the committee was harder than the latter anticipated. It seemed self-evident afterward, but it took a long time to come to this conclusion and to convince others. Of course, he later admitted narrowing the prize down in this way would immediately knock out some of the obvious contenders, namely Shapley and Schelling. And here was the real bone of contention. Focusing on non-cooperative theory also meant that it would be difficult to deny Nash the prize. Once we decided to limit the prize to non-cooperative theory, then it was very easy to decide who were the key contributors. Then it was obvious that Nash is part of the Nobel. Lindbeck proposed a three-way prize for the definition of equilibria in non-cooperative games, Nash, Harzanyi, and Zeltan. This was where the debate got nasty. The person on the committee least intimidated by Lindbeck, and best equipped intellectually to challenge him, was Ingemar Stahl, a 60-year-old professor at Lund with a joint appointment in economics and law. Stahl was a quick study and a brilliant debater, a man who delights in taking contrarian, often extreme, positions in any debate. He had long been one of the most active committee members and had written many of the committee's prize proposals since the early 1980s. Stahl is short, with a large head and a big belly. His detractors call him Zwergel, or Little Dwarf, behind his back. A one-time wunderkind who never quite lived up to his early promise, Stahl owes the prestigious chair at Lund, his academy membership, and his longtime position on the prize committee more to his political connections and his high-profile posture in public policy debates than to his research output. Like Lindbeck, Stahl began his upward climb early, while he was still in high school, as a protege of various social democratic politicians, including Palm, but he had gone over to the conservative opposition in the late 1960s. Stahl was deeply and adamantly opposed to awarding the prize to Nash. From the start, he was highly skeptical of game theory, as indeed he is of all pure theory. He is an institutionalist, likes intuitive rather than formal reasoning, and is leery of mathematics and technicians. He was, for example, a main mover behind the prize for James Buchanan in 1986, and Ronald Coase in 1991, economists whose theories focus on the way governments and legal structures affect the workings of markets. He also prides himself on grasping Nobel politics. The more he learned about Nash, the less he liked the idea of giving Nash a prize. In particular, he considered giving the prize to Nash the kind of ill-considered gesture that was likely to result in embarrassment, and more important, make the committee look bad. "I knew he had been ill," he said later. "I didn't think many people knew about it. I guess I heard Hormander's version." Stahl had done quite a bit of digging. In the early fall, he had made a call to Lars Hormander, Sweden's most eminent mathematician and winner of the 1962 Fields Medal. Hormander had just retired from the University of Lund. Stahl identified himself as a member of the Nobel Prize Committee. He'd heard that Hormander had known Nash quite well in the 1950s and 1960s, he said. The committee was thinking of giving Nash a Nobel Prize. Could Hormander give him the lowdown on Nash? Hormander was surprised. Like most other pure mathematicians, he didn't think much of Nash's work in game theory. And the last time Hormander had laid eyes on Nash was in the academic year 1977-78. Hormander had been in Princeton, and he had seen Nash hanging around Fine Hall. Nash was a ghost. Hormander didn't think Nash had recognized him or had even been aware of his presence. Hormander hadn't even tried to speak with him. To give such a man a prize seemed to him absurd. Risky. Hormander was precise and frank. His memories of Nash were extremely distasteful. He recalled Nash's decision to give up his citizenship, his deportation first from Switzerland, then from France, Nash's bizarre behavior at the 1962 conference in Paris, the stream of anonymous cards with their hints of envy and hostility that came after Hormander won the fields in 1962. Stahl had also made inquiries among several psychiatrists he knew who, he says, described the illness as unlike depression or mania, where the self remains intermittently at least recognizable. "I knew this type of illness," he said later. "I know some psychiatrists here, some of the best head shrinkers. When I talked to them, I found out that with this disease there is a complete change of personality. He is not the man who did the thing." Lindbeck, relying on reports from Weibel and Kuhn, was telling committee members that Nash was much improved, that he had in fact recovered his sanity. About this, too, Stahl was deeply skeptical. The psychiatrists he spoke to told him that schizophrenia is a chronic, unremitting, degenerative disease. "It's a very tragic illness. It gets calmed down, but actually recovering is another matter." Stahl knew that there was great sympathy for Nash, and he could see that Lindbeck had made up his mind, so he didn't attack frontally, but simply raised question after question. "He'd throw out an argument and somebody would shoot it down," said another member of the committee. "Then he'd shift to another argument. He tried to irritate us and confuse us, to raise doubts." Stahl would say, "He's sick. You can't have a person like that." He asked what would happen at the ceremony. Would he come? Could he handle it? It's a big show. He quoted Hormander and others who had known Nash in the 1950s and 1960s. He read them what he considered a particularly damning quotation from a book by Martin Shubik, who had known Nash as a graduate student. "The most damning thing," Stahl repeated later, "was something Martin Shubik wrote in one of his books, that you can only understand the Nash equilibrium if you have met Nash. It's a game, and it's played alone." He brought up Nash's work for Rand. "These guys worked with the atom bomb during the Cold War. It would be a shameful thing for the prize." He brought up Nash's lack of interest in game theory after graduate school. As Lindbeck, Jacobson, the Academy's Secretary General, and others later hinted, Stahl was not the first member of a Nobel Prize committee who was motivated by deep animus toward a particular candidate, or who embraced a wide range of intellectual objections in an effort to derail the candidate. But as the spring wore on, Stahl made a great many midnight phone calls. He seemed, Weibel later recalled, to be trying out any and all arguments against Nash's candidacy. What was certainly the case throughout those months, a member of the Swedish Academy said, was a growing feeling on Stahl's and others' part that a few bad choices would sink the prize. Nash was, of course, a very weak choice. People were afraid that the thing would blow up, a big scandal. And David Warsh, a syndicated columnist in whom Stahl evidently confided, subsequently wrote, "The whole intellectual world is watching to see what the Swedish Academy of Sciences is going to do about Nash. The Swedes are known to be worried about what Nash might say." Christer Kiselman, head of the mathematics class of the Academy at the time, and a member of the Academy's governing council, remembers talking to Stahl. He recalls that Stahl told him that Nash's work was done too long ago and was too mathematical to warrant a prize. Kiselman, whose son Ola has suffered from schizophrenia since age 16, had a different interpretation. "Stahl was afraid of schizophrenia, so he had some prejudices. So he thought other people would think the same way. He was afraid of some scandal that would reflect on the committee." One by one, Lindbeck knocked down Stahl's objections. Lindbeck has a reputation for courage. He has never been afraid to take unpopular positions, even at the risk of alienating his political allies. In the late 1970s, for example, he had publicly opposed a favorite Social Democrat proposal to promote worker ownership of manufacturing concerns that had become trendy. Now Lindbeck took the position that Stahl's objections, that Nash was a mathematician, that Nash had stopped being interested in game theory 40 years earlier, that Nash was mentally ill, were irrelevant. He too was worried that Nash would do something peculiar at the ceremony, but he was sure that could be managed. In any case, it was no basis for denying the prize to someone who was, on intellectual grounds, obviously worthy. Besides, he found that his emotions were involved. Most laureates were already famous and much honored. The Nobel was only a crowning glory. But in Nash's case, it was quite different. Lindbeck thought a great deal about the misery of his life and that Nash had been, for all intents and purposes, forgotten. Later he was to say, Nash was different. He had gotten no recognition and was living in real misery. We helped lift him into daylight. We resurrected him in a way. It was emotionally satisfying.